And now it's time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. Uncle Dennis here at Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101 FM and www.freakradio.org on Thursday, February 23rd. I'd like to ask you to have a pencil and paper handy so that you can write down names, addresses, telephone numbers, web pages, URLs, whatever it takes to get the action underway. Let's start with announcements. The California Native Plant Society, Santa Cruz County Chapter Habitat Restoration Team is having a restoration this Saturday, February 27th from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Quail Hollow Ranch County Park. Spring is starting to show up here and there, and it's time to get out and start looking for native wildflowers. We may see manzanita and ceanothus, red maids, and maybe some showy pink flowering currants. We will continue, however, with our restoration efforts, removing non-native invasive French broom in the oak woodland areas of Quail Hollow Ranch. Hope to see you out there. To get to Quail Hollow, take Graham Hill Road north from Santa Cruz, come down the hill into Felton, turn right at the first light, go up East Diani Road for a couple of miles, turn left on Quail Hollow. Half a mile in is the park entrance, meet in the gravel parking lot on the left-hand side of the entrance road. The Habitat Restoration Team is an all-volunteer group working to restore native habitat in the parks and protected lands of Santa Cruz County. Their program helps to provide an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80. Wear comfortable layered clothing, bring something to drink, and lots of enthusiasm. They work rain or shine, but if things get particularly unpleasant, they'll call it a day. I don't think that's going to happen this Saturday. Tools are provided. Bring gloves and water. If you want more information, contact the program leader, Linda. Her number, 831-462-4041. That's 831-462-4041. You could email her at REDWDRN. That's REDWDRN at pacbell.net, or go to the website www.cruzcnps.org. And here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field for this week. On Saturday, Buffalo Field Campaign patrols witnessed the capture of 24 of America's last wild buffalo in Yellowstone's infamous Stevens Creek traps. As of Thursday morning, these buffalo are still in the outer catch pens. According to the Park Service, these 24 will continue to be held through the weekend and will not be processed or shipped to slaughter this week. There is a chance they could be released, and we must increase the pressure to urge Yellowstone to do the right thing, and we'll have information on that in just a second. There are approximately 250 buffalo south of the trap in the Gardner Basin out inside Yellowstone's boundaries. We're watching the trap and monitoring the buffalo very closely. Please help the buffalo by contacting Yellowstone National Park today and demanding that they release the buffalo and end plans to capture any more. There is absolutely no justification for their capture or slaughter, as these actions are being carried out for the sole purpose of appeasing the intolerance of Montana's livestock interests. Here's how to contact Yellowstone Superintendent Dan Wink. That number is 307-344-2002. That's Superintendent Dan Wink, 307-344-2002. Or you could email him at dan_wenk@nps.gov. That's dan_wenk@nps.gov. With an early spell of warm weather and Yellowstone initiating capture for slaughter operations, there are no buffalo in the hot zone for hunters to kill. The state hunting season ended February 15th, but there are still a few tribes hunting under treaty rights. With no buffalo available on the landscape, treaty hunters, who hold rights to hunt, gather, and fish any plants or animals they choose, are turning to elk, many of which are grazing throughout the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. The taking of elk, so coveted by Montana's hunting constituency, has certain individuals in the Gardner community up in arms. On Monday night, a town meeting was called by Bill and Pat Hoppy, two locals who are known for their anti-wildlife sentiments. They were a frightening lot to behold, embodying the centuries-old mentality that has always been a threat to the wild and the indigenous. More than 70 people attended, including the Buffalo Field Campaign, who was the only voice to speak in favor of the buffalo, the tribes, and treaty rights. Attendees even went so far as to question the legality of treaty rights, suggesting breaking or amending them, and some made extremely racist comments towards the tribes. It is imperative to understand that this situation has been set up by the government and anti-Buffalo interests to play out exactly as it has. Now that sights have been turned on a few elk, some locals are suddenly crying foul. More than 400 wild buffalo have been killed by hunters this winter, and none of these folks complained about a few elk being killed have raised any fuss about that. They want buffalo dead, and they don't care how it's done or who does it. Elk, however, bring in big bucks, and more than a few hunting outfitters were in attendance. What it really boils down to is that treaty hunters taking elk are hurting business. It seems none of these folks care if hundreds or thousands of wild buffalo, vulnerable to global extinction and innocent in the brucellosis argument, are killed, but take a few elk who have been implicated in transmitting brucellosis to livestock out of the teeming population, and you begin to see the deeply rooted prejudice against the buffalo. Buffalo Field Campaign stood alone in speaking up for the buffalo and in solidarity with tribes and their treaty rights. We should also give credit to Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Region 3 Director Sam Shepard, who was very just in his communications with the angry mob. If you'd like to reach the Buffalo Field Campaign, they're at P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. That address again, Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. If you want to talk to anybody there, give them a call at 406-646-0070. Once again, that number, 406-646-0070. All this information and more can be found at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. The Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And 13 bald eagles have been found dead in Maryland in this story by John Clark, with editing by Sandra Mahler, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. Authorities are investigating the deaths of 13 bald eagles discovered on a Maryland farm in the state's largest die-off of the national bird in 30 years, officials said recently. Maryland Natural Resources Police received a call from a man reporting 4 dead eagles near Federalsburg in the eastern part of the state, said spokesperson Candy Thompson. Officers arrived and discovered 9 more birds dead nearby. Catherine Hibbert, a spokesperson for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which is investigating the deaths, said the cause of death was unknown, pending a medical examination. The maximum fine for harming a bald eagle is $100,000 and up to a year in prison, she added. The bald eagle, which has almost disappeared from the United States decades ago, was removed from the Federal Endangered Species List in August of 2007 after the banning of the pesticide DDT and habitat protection led to its recovery, according to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The bald eagle is a symbol of the federal government and is featured on the presidential seal and on U.S. currency. The bird is federally protected. Thompson said the 13 birds represent Maryland's largest bald eagle die-off in 30 years. And a $25,000 reward is being offered for information about this incident. The reward is being offered by the Humane Society of the United States, Humane Society Wildlife Land Trust, Phoenix Wildlife Center, the Center for Biological Diversity, and the Fish and Wildlife Service. And the BLM targets open pipes and mining claim markers in an effort to reduce bird deaths, in this story by Steve Holmer of the American Bird Conservancy. The Bureau of Land Management today took action to reduce the serious threat to birds, issuing a memorandum to its field offices across the nation with guidance on how to eliminate the threat of open pipes on public lands. Open pipes, such as uncapped PVC pipes used to mark mining claims, are death traps for hundreds of thousands of birds and other wildlife each year. Animals become trapped inside the pipes and are unable to escape, starving and dying of dehydration. More than 3 million mining claims use these pipes as boundary markers. This is a small change that will make a big difference, said BLM Director Neil Corns. Too often birds, bats, lizards, snakes, and small mammals find themselves unable to escape from these pipes and vents. The memorandum calls for BLM staff to identify all vertical pipes in BLM-managed lands and to cap, close, remove, or screen them to prevent wildlife from becoming trapped. In addition, all vertical pipes on future facilities must have permanent caps or screens to prevent harm to wildlife. Mine claim holders are also being encouraged to voluntarily remove PVC pipes used as mine markers to replace them with wildlife-safe markers. This is a positive step in the right direction, said Steve Homer, senior policy advisor for the American Bird Conservancy, which has long advocated for eliminating this threat to birds on public lands. The threat of open pipes can easily be prevented, and today's action moves us closer to solving the problem. In June, more than 100 groups led by the American Bird Conservancy sent a joint letter to the BLM and the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Forest Service, asking the two agencies to accelerate efforts to address this long-standing threat to birds. Much work remains to be done to remove existing hazards, and long-term policies and procedures still need to be established to prevent this bird mortality from continuing to occur on public lands in the future, the letter states. The group specifically asked the BLM and the Forest Service to take three key actions: issue national policy directives to remove or modify existing pipes, and to delineate standards to prevent the use of open pipes in the future. Initiate a federal rulemaking to require mining claim holders to replace pipes that can cause mortality, and to use wildlife safe markers on all current and future claims. And third, dedicate sufficient resources annually to educate mine claim holders on this issue, to coordinate and carry out partnership efforts to remove pipes, and to carry out necessary infrastructure improvements within the public lands and national forest systems. Today's memorandum makes significant progress towards establishing a national policy, the first item on the list, and outreach to mine claim holders is also underway, said Homer. We would now like to see the Forest Service and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service take similar action to make sure this problem does not continue to recur on national forests and national wildlife refuges. According to the BLM publication Public Land Statistics in 2014, 3.5 million mining claims were on record on BLM-managed lands in 11 contiguous western states and Alaska. Nevada had the most with 1.1 million claims, followed by Utah with 412,000. Wyoming, which includes minimal numbers from Nebraska at 314,000, California has 311,000, and Colorado 285,000. An examination of 854 pipes in the state of Nevada revealed 879 dead birds, an average of more than one bird death per pipe, as well as 113 reptiles and mammals. Of the 43 species of birds recovered from the markers by the Nevada Department of Wildlife, most were cavity nesters. The ash-throated flycatcher and the mountain bluebird were the most frequent victims, but other species commonly trapped included woodpeckers, sparrows, shrikes, kestrels, and owls. This threat to birds has been documented from Oregon to New Mexico. In November 2011, BLM specialists in Oregon documented alarming rates of bird mortality at claims in the Burns area. One researcher stated in his written report that the toll to birds could be enormous. A single uncapped vertical PVC pipe can potentially entrap and kill dozens of native birds of multiple species. Pipe pulling efforts have so far documented as many as 30 bird mortalities in a single pipe. Meanwhile, Forest Service staff are covering open vent pipes on outhouses, also known to trap birds. For more information, go to the webpage www.abcbirds.org. A major ivory trafficking network has been broken up in the Democratic Republic of Congo in this story from the World Wildlife Fund. In a significant blow to the illegal ivory trade in the Democratic Republic of Congo, authorities dismantled a major ivory trafficking syndicate thanks to a law enforcement supported by the World Wildlife Fund and partners. Congolese authorities seized approximately 66 pounds of ivory tusks and ornaments on February 4th and arrested a number of traffickers who remain in police custody. With thousands of elephants poached each year, this crackdown represents a major step forward in stopping wildlife crime. World Wildlife Fund congratulates the DRC government for successfully breaking up this ivory trafficking network, said Bruno Prudeau, WWF DRC Conservation Director. This crackdown shows that ivory traffickers can no longer count on impunity for their crimes in this country, and demonstrates that with determination we can be successful in the fight against wildlife crime, even in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The Congo rainforest, home to the African forest elephant, is the world's second largest rainforest, two-thirds of which are found in the DRC, where elephant poaching continues at an industrial scale. If poaching is not stopped, the species could all but disappear from the DRC in the near future, following in the footsteps of several other iconic species, such as the northern white rhino. The Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, or CITES, a treaty that regulates international trade in wild flora and fauna, requested the DRC provide an action plan for combating wildlife crime and the ivory trade in 2014. Last March, CITES recommended certain commercial sanctions with the DRC because it didn't finalize the action plan within the agreed time frame. Faced with the threat of these sanctions, the DRC has started to act on wildlife crime, completing and using the action plan and cracking down on a key ivory trafficking network. As many as 30,000 elephants are killed for their ivory every year. To end this tragedy, the World Wildlife Fund focuses on zero poaching efforts, reducing demand for ivory parts, and breaking trafficking links. Along with governments, communities, and supporters like you, we can put an end to wildlife crime. To find out how you can help, go to www.worldwildlife.org. That's www.worldwildlife.org. And hatchery life changes fish genetics, an Oregon study finds in this story by Kelly House of the Oregonian and found on Oregon Live. A new study out of Oregon State University lays to rest the debate over whether hatchery life changes fish at the genetic level. It does, and the changes happen at an astonishingly rapid pace. The study, published recently in the journal Nature Communications, finds that after only one generation of domestication, the DNA of hatchery steelhead trout are substantially different from the DNA of steelhead whose parents were wild. In other words, the fish begin evolving to suit their habitat in just a single generation. We're showing that at the DNA level, hatchery and wild fish pass on something different to their offspring, said Michael Bloom, a OSU researcher who served as principal investigator on the study. Bloom said the findings prove some scientists' long-held suspicions about why the offspring of hatchery-raised fish are less likely to survive in the wild than the offspring of wild fish. Several studies have shown that hatchery-raised fish and wild fish differ in their survival and reproductive success, but it remained unclear whether learned behavior changes or DNA-level differences were behind the phenomena. The research by Bloom and his team makes it clear that genetics plays a role. The team conducted their study using wild and hatchery-raised steelhead from the Hood River. They bred the fish, then raised their offsprings, batches of fertilized eggs with two wild parents, with two hatchery-raised parents, and with one wild parent and one parent from a hatchery, in identical conditions. When they were done, they compared the genetics of each class of fish. Fish with hatchery-raised parents differed in their activity of more than 700 genes when compared to fish from wild parents. The fish had all been reared in the same environment, and their parents had been caught in the same water. The only difference, Bloom said, is who their parents were. It's not clear what traits are being selected for, nor what environmental factors are driving the evolution, but if scientists can pinpoint these details, hatchery managers could make changes at their facilities to produce hatchery fish that are as genetically similar as possible to their wild counterparts. For example, if overcrowded conditions in hatcheries are promoting a DNA change that makes fish more docile, hatchery managers could feasibly design hatcheries with more room for fish to grow in hopes of avoiding the DNA changes. That could do much to alleviate the concerns over whether our hatchery systems are making it harder for wild fish to survive. Although the system is designed to prevent interbreeding, some hatchery-raised fish inevitably spawn with wild fish. Some fish advocates worry that over time interbreeding leads to genetic changes that make wild fish less fit to survive in their environment. There's a potential to make hatchery fish that end up more like wild fish, and then everybody's happier, Bloom said. And let's turn to some biological diversity news. A plan to strip wolf protections has been cut from a budget deal. Provisions were meant to strip federal protections from wolves in four states were not included in the final budget in Congress. That move could have been a disaster, ending Endangered Species Act protection in Wyoming, Minnesota, Michigan, and Wisconsin, pushing aside decades of work to recover wolves there. The Center for Biological Diversity has been on the front lines of the fight against these anti-wildlife measures since the very beginning, and we never let up. Thanks to all our supporters who made phone calls, sent letters, or otherwise raised their voices for wolves. And scientists have asked California to label atrazine products as toxic. About 80 million pounds of the toxic pesticide atrazine were used in the United States each year, threatening our water supplies. The pesticides is also linked to thyroid cancer and birth defects in people, as well as chemical castration, even when the toxin is present at very low levels in frogs. Dr. Tyrone Hayes, a prominent pesticide researcher, along with American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, California chapter, representing thousands of members and many other scientists, called on California officials to protect residents from products containing the chemical, which has long been banned in Europe. The Center for Biological Diversity and the Center for Environmental Health sent separate letters expressing their concerns. The scientists criticized California's recently proposed safe threshold for atrazine because the state relied mostly on unpublished 1996 study funded by the pesticide industry. More recent independent studies indicate that the threshold proposed by the state fails to provide adequate protection from this toxic pesticide. California has discounted high-quality research in favor of an industry-funded study, said Dr. Nathan Donnelly, the center scientist. The state must reverse course and use the best available science to inform this important decision. And an imperiled blackbird wins protection in California. Following center petitions, the California Fish and Game Commission has declared tricolored blackbirds a candidate for protection under the California Endangered Species Act. The birds will now enjoy the act's protection for a year while the commission decides whether to add them to the state's official endangered species list. Tricolored blackbirds, unrelated to common blackbirds, have red and white patched wings on the males and form the largest colonies of any North American land bird. In the 19th century, some colonies contained more than 1 million individuals, which someone described as darkening the sky for some distance by their masses, such as passenger pigeons did once, before they were driven extinct. Although tricolors haven't disappeared yet, over the past 70 years, habitat destruction has slashed populations to a fraction of their former enormity. Center for Biological Diversity petitioned to protect the tricolored blackbird under both the California and Federal Endangered Species Act in 2004, petitioned California again on an emergency basis last year. The state has finally acknowledged the bird's urgent danger. And the candidate list for protection hits historic low numbers. Some important progress in our fight to save wildlife. The number of animals and plants on the waiting list for Federal Endangered Species Act protection has dropped to its lowest ever since the candidate list was begun in the 1970s, according to the list released at the end of 2015. The backlog on the list has been vastly reduced since a historical settlement secured by the center and other groups in 2011 created a legally binding deadline for the government to make protection decisions for hundreds of species. Under that agreement, 151 birds, butterflies, frogs, and other species have gained Endangered Species Act protection, and another 71 have been proposed for protection. The candidate list in 2010 was 251 species. At the end of 2015, it was down to 60. It's heartening to see so many animals and plants get the life-saving protection they need. And a gem-like beetle in Florida has moved closer to federal protection. In response to a petition from the Center for Biological Diversity and their partners, the Fish and Wildlife Service is proposing to protect the Miami tiger beetle, found only in the pine rocklands of southern Florida, under the Endangered Species Act. We petitioned to protect this species in December of 2014 after learning it's imminently threatened by a planned strip mall featuring a Walmart and a proposed theme park. Watching the Miami tiger beetle forage with its shiny iridescent body and lightning-quick legs is mesmerizing, said Jacqueline Lopez, Florida director for the Center for Biological Diversity. Endangered Species Act protection will help ensure the beetle's rare pine rockland hunting grounds remain intact in the face of overpressing development. South Florida's pine rocklands are some of the most imperiled habitats in the world and harbor several other endangered species, including the Florida bonneted bat and Bartram scrub hairstreak butterfly, which will also benefit if the Miami tiger beetle is protected. And Long Beach has run out of time on offshore fracking permits. We celebrated the news of the city of Long Beach has run out of time to use 13 permits issued by state oil officials for offshore fracking in California waters. California's Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources issued the permits last June, just weeks after the devastating Refugio oil spill in Santa Barbara. Long Beach had planned to use two chemicals identified by the California Council on Science and Technology as among the most toxic substances on Earth to aquatic life. The permits expired at the end of the year, and there isn't enough time to conduct legally required reviews to make them active, according to a letter the center sent to the city. It's a huge relief that these offshore fracking permits won't be used and a major victory for California's coastal environment, said the center's Kristen Monsell. This toxic technique has no place in our ocean. Every offshore frack puts coastal communities and sea otters and other marine wildlife at risk from dangerous chemicals or another devastating oil spill. And Congress has passed a ban on plastic microbeads in beauty products. The U.S. Senate has unanimously supported a bill phasing out the manufacturing of beauty products with plastic microbeads on July 1, 2017, and the sale of such products by July 1, 2018. The Microbead Free Waters Act bans all plastic microbeads in beauty products, including those made from so-called biodegradable plastics, the majority of which do not biodegrade in marine environments. The law will prevent 1.4 trillion with a T plastic microbeads from entering U.S. waterways each year. Plastic microbeads, designed to be washed down the drain and too small to be reliably captured by wastewater treatment facilities, pollute lakes, rivers, and oceans. They concentrate toxins like pesticides and flame retardants on their surface, which may then transfer to the tissue of fish that ingest them. Our oceans have been choking on these tiny plastic microbeads for way too long. This is a huge and important step towards protecting fish, birds, and other ocean wildlife hurt by plastic pollution, said Miyoko Sakashida, the Center for Biological Diversity's Oceans Program Director. And a suit has been filed to safeguard the coastal marten. The Center for Biological Diversity's and their partners have sued to grant critical protections to one of the Pacific Northwest's most endangered old-growth animals, the coastal marten, the bushy-tailed carnivore related to mink and otter, gravely imperiled by logging, fire, climate change, rodenticides, and more. About 2 feet long, with large triangular ears and a long tail, coastal martens, sometimes known as Humboldt martens, are known for their slinky movements and sly hunting skills. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org. You can listen to a rebroadcast tomorrow afternoon. That's Friday at 3 p.m. right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. If you're in the Moscow, Idaho area, listen to KRFP, Radio Free Moscow, 90.3 FM on 3 p.m. on Wednesdays. And you can listen to Truth and Justice Radio, WZBC, Boston, Massachusetts, 90.3 FM from 6 to 10 a.m. on Sundays. The Grateful Dread Public Radio and Internet Radio Station airs the Earth First Update Sundays at 2 a.m. Go to gdprnashville.org. That's gdprnashville.org. And you can get them on TuneIn and Spotify. And you can go to radioforall.net. That's radio, the number, forall.net, where you can listen online or download this or previous editions of the Earth First Update. And please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It's free to download. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening, and do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.